This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Japan is facing growing fears that radioactivity from a damaged nuclear power station has contaminated food and water supplies. The restoration of electricity at the Fukushima plant raised hopes that the crisis there was coming to an end. But a number of countries have now banned food imports from areas near the nuclear power plant. Japanese authorities also warned that infants should not drink tap water even in Tokyo, more than 200 kilometers southwest of the plant. And Tokyo residents say they are concerned about high levels of radioactive iodine in their water supply. To help us understand what is happening in Japan, we are joined on the phone by Gordon Edwards. Gordon Edwards is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Hello, Gordon, and thanks for joining us.
Hello, Sean. How are you?
Great, thank you. From what you have been able to gather, do they have things under control there in Fukushima?
Well, they're struggling to keep things from getting out of control, I think, is a more accurate way of putting it. They keep getting one setback after another. The most recent one was the discovery of water in the turbine building that was 10,000 times more radioactive than they had anticipated. And I'm sure that your listeners have probably heard about the two or three workers who were hospitalized because of radiation burns to their feet as a result of that, stepping into the radioactive water. The difficulty here is that that water is so radioactive that it could only have come from the core of the reactor. And that raises the question of whether there is, in fact, a breach or a crack or a hole in the containment vessel, which is a 17-centimeter thick steel vessel surrounding the core of the reactor, and which up till now they've assumed has been intact. So it's very worrisome, and they're continuing to struggle with it.
What would that mean? If there were a breach in the containment vessel, what would that mean?
Well, depending, first of all, it may not be a breach in the containment vessel. It may be just a breach somewhere else in the primary cooling circuit, because from the reactor vessel, there are pipes that go around in a circuit that to deliver the steam to the steam turbines to generate electricity. Actually, nuclear power is just another way of boiling water, and the reactor is really a boiler. It's a great big boiler. It could be a leak from another portion of the primary cooling circuit, and that would be a little easier for them perhaps to deal with, because a hole in the reactor vessel would be very, very difficult to repair. The problem is that if you don't cool the core of the reactor, it is going to melt all by itself, and this is a fundamental fact of physics. Every nuclear reactor in the world has this same property, that if you shut down all the pumps immediately and shut off all the electricity and just walked away from it, it would spontaneously melt down at a temperature of thousands of degrees Fahrenheit, about 2,800 degrees Celsius. And the reason for that is because although we can shut off the electricity and we can shut off the fission process and we can shut down the reactor, nobody knows how to shut off the radioactivity. And the heat that's being generated in these Japan reactors is solely because of the radioactivity. Where did the radioactivity come from? Well, it came because we created it when we were generating electricity. We were splitting the atoms of uranium, and when the atoms of uranium split, they turn into hundreds of different broken pieces of uranium atoms, and these different pieces are highly unstable, therefore radioactive, and they go by many different names like iodine-131, cesium-137, krypton-85, strontium-90, and we have over 211 of them listed on our webpage. Anybody can go there and take a look. And those are the things which are generating all this heat, and nobody knows how to shut them off.
Well, I know they were using seawater and mixed with chemicals to try and cool the core there. Are they still using that combination?
No, they're moving now to fresh water, which is being brought in by American vessels. They're bringing in huge quantities of fresh water. The reason they couldn't use fresh water before is because the tsunami had mucked up the water terribly. It churned up so much junk, so much crap in the water, that if they had tried to use that so-called fresh water in the reactor core, it would have fouled the machinery terribly. So the only reason they were using seawater was to try and get water that was relatively free of debris. Now that they have a supply of fresh water, they have already restored in unit number one, they've restored fresh water to filling the vessel with fresh water. They have to keep filling the vessel over and over again because the heat from the radioactivity continually evaporates the water. And as long as the water is evaporating, it needs to be replenished.
Now, in practical terms, how much damage has been done to the Japanese environment so far?
Well, that's impossible to say, partly because they're not giving out scientifically accurate information. For example, they're only talking about a handful of radioactive materials, and these are the ones which are of most immediate health concern, such as radioactive iodine, which has a short half-life, but which is very dangerous to all living things, particularly to humans, especially infants. The reason why is because the body doesn't... Well, first of all, I should say, the background level of radioactive iodine in the environment before nuclear power was zero. The background level of radioactive cesium was also zero. The background level of plutonium was also zero. So when they talk about background radiation, this is really misleading. This is not background radiation at all. These are man-made radioactive poisons for which there is no background. Now, the body concentrates iodine, normal iodine, which is non-radioactive. That does exist. And normal iodine is very useful for the body. It goes to the thyroid gland and is used to help regulate thyroid functions. So the radioactive iodine also goes to the same gland, but there it causes damage. And that damage can cause things like mental retardation, it can cause stunted growth, it can cause various developmental abnormalities in young children and infants, and it can also cause thyroid cancer. There have been 5,000 children in Belarus, according to the World Health Organization, who had to have their thyroid gland surgically removed because of thyroid cancer caused by the Chernobyl accident. We believe it's, in fact, quite a bit more than 5,000, but that's what they count. So this is the problem, is that these radioactive materials, the body has no experience with them prior to the advent of nuclear power. The body thinks it's just good nutrition and puts it in the organs of the body which normally food would go to, not realizing that these things are dangerous because they're radioactive. And what happens in the body is that these radioactive atoms behave just like normal atoms, except for the fact that they suddenly will explode. And when they explode, this is called a radioactive disintegration. And when you get one of these radioactive disintegrations, it gives off shrapnel, subatomic shrapnel, which is called alpha, beta, and gamma rays. And the alpha, beta, and gamma rays damage the nearby cells. And those cells, in many cases, the cells are killed, and that's a good thing because they can then be removed by the body. But if they're damaged and able to reproduce, they can develop abnormally in many different ways. And this is why you can see cancers 10, 15, 20 years later developing in people who were exposed to radiation today. So this is really the problem. It's the long term. The Japanese government is fond of saying right now there is no immediate health danger. Well, in a sense, that's right, because you're not going to get sick today. But the damage is being done today that may result in cancers 20 years later. So, but that damage is irreversible.
There have been concerns about the radioactive particles spreading to other areas of Japan and also even to other countries. What do you see happening in that regard?
Well, there's no doubt that it is spreading around the world. Just as atmospheric fallout from bomb testing, when they exploded atomic bombs in the American desert, the fallout from those bombs went all over the world and is still, in fact, coming down today, although diminishing year by year because we're not doing that anymore. We're not exploding bombs in the atmosphere. Well, inside each one of these reactors, there's more radioactive poison, more radioactive fallout potentially than you would find in 1,000 Hiroshima-type bombs. In fact, in these six reactors that we're talking about here, there's more radioactive cesium in those six reactors than there would be in all the bombs that have been tested so far. If you look at all the bombs that have been tested both above ground and below ground, There's more radioactive cesium in these six reactors than all of them. Now, up till the present time, only a small fraction of that cesium has been released to the environment because the fuel itself has not completely melted. Once the fuel completely melts, if it ever did, and hopefully they will be able to prevent that, but if the fuel was to completely melt as it did at Chernobyl, then you would have much greater releases of these radioactive materials. And it's not just iodine and cesium. You have strontium, you have ruthenium, you have tellurium, you have plutonium, you have americium. There's dozens and dozens of different materials, and they pose different dangers. For example, iodine has a half-life. A half-life means how long it takes for half of the atoms to disintegrate. So it means that if you had, for example, a kilogram of radioactive iodine, then in 8 days it would only be half a kilogram. And then in another 8 days it would only be a quarter of a kilogram, and so on. So the iodine is very dangerous in the immediate time frame, but it's going to be mostly gone in a year. Whereas the cesium has a 30-year half-life, so it's going to be around for many, many decades and even centuries. And americium-241, which is a notoriously toxic material, which comes out of the unit number 3 especially, this has a half-life of 430 years, so it's going to be around for many, many centuries. And plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years, so it's going to be around forever. So these materials, they have different pathways through the body, different pathways through the environment, and they're going to be a problem for varying lengths of time, depending upon which one you're talking about. At the present time, the Japanese government is not giving any quantitative measurements of how much of these things have been released. The only thing that I've been able to determine so far is that they have, in the first 3 days, released about 50% of the amount of cesium-137 that was released in 10 days from Chernobyl. So that's a lot.
Well, that's some pretty disturbing information. When a disaster like this happens, it's hard not to turn our gaze inward and wonder about the safety of our own nuclear power plants here in Canada. How safe are they?
Well, they all suffer from the same basic problem. And although the industry, you know, the people in the industry are largely physicists and engineers. They're not basically biomedical people. You won't find very many biomedically trained people in the nuclear industry. So they tend to think in terms of machinery, in terms of engineering, and they're very proud of their engineering, as they should be. The engineering is actually quite wonderful. They've got all these automatic systems, computerized systems, control systems, backup systems, emergency pumps, emergency electrical supplies. It's fantastic. But they all failed at Fukushima. They all failed. And although it's tempting to blame this on a 9.0 earthquake followed by a tsunami, actually, it could have been brought about otherwise. For example, if you built nuclear reactors in a war zone, then the effects of warfare could bring about the same consequences by wiping out the power supply. All you have to do is basically wipe out the off-site power and the on-site power so that there's no backup, and you're going to see the same thing in any nuclear reactor in the world. Now, here in Canada, and this can happen even by accident, here in Canada there was a report published in Ontario in 1978. It's on our website. It's called A Race Against Time, and it's the report on nuclear power in Ontario by the Royal Commission on Electric Power Planning. And they said, and by the way, 1978, when this was published, was before there had ever been a nuclear accident in a commercial reactor of this scale. It was 1 year before Three Mile Island, right? And what they said is that if we look at Canada and look at the CANDU reactor that we have, if we had 100 reactors operating in this country at some future time, then we could expect a meltdown perhaps possibly as often as once every 40 years just because of accidental conditions. In other words, you have a bad day. You know, the switch doesn't work, the electricity doesn't work, the pumps don't work. Just accidents, or normal industrial accidents. Once every 40 years, that's pretty frightening.
Well, it would seem that this disaster might cause our government to reconsider its nuclear program, but with the price of oil going up as well because of the issues in the Middle East, that's a counter argument. What are the chances that a moratorium on nuclear power might happen in Canada?
Well, actually, as bad as the oil price has been in terms of going up, and everybody agrees that we should get off oil anyway for other reasons, you know, the problem is that nuclear power costs have been going up even faster than oil prices. They've been going up so fast that it just about gives you a sense of vertigo. The result is that the nuclear renaissance, which people have talked about, you know, that it's been promoted by the nuclear industry, we're going to have this wonderful nuclear renaissance, it simply hasn't happened. And one of the reasons it hasn't happened is because the smart money will not invest in nuclear power. If you look at the investment companies, Wall Street and so on, they simply will not invest in nuclear power unless they have loan guarantees. That means that they don't want to take any risk. So they want loan guarantees from the public purse, that only if the public will give the guarantees will they invest in it. It's similar in Canada. When we sell reactors overseas, the banks will not finance it. For example, Prime Minister Chrétien had to take from the federal treasury, from the taxpayers, he had to take $2 billion and give it to China as a loan in order to finance the sale of those CANDU reactors. So the question is, why wouldn't the banks invest in this if they think it's a good deal? So the finances of nuclear are very bad. The other thing about nuclear is that it can't possibly solve the global warming problem. It can't possibly make a huge dent in greenhouse gas reduction, because in fact even the most optimistic projections say that for the next 40 years at least, nuclear cannot make a contribution because the old plants are going to be shut down faster than the new plants can possibly be built, and so they're going to be lucky to just stand still. As a matter of fact, in the last couple of years, the contribution of electricity, nuclear electricity in the world, has gone down from 16% of total electricity globally to 14%. So it's already on the decline. And people expect, even the optimists, expect that it's going to be declining for at least the next 10 years and maybe for the next 40 years.
Well, Gordon, thanks so much for joining us today. Did you have one thing you wanted to add?
I just want to add one more thing, and that is that Germany is a good case in point. If I could just say something about the German situation. Germany had a vote 10 years ago, and they passed a law for phasing out nuclear power in Germany. In that 10-year interval, they built 30,000 megawatts of wind power. Now, 30,000 megawatts is more than double the entire Canadian nuclear industry. 15,000 megawatts is what we have in Canada of nuclear, if they were all working, which they're not. So the fact that you can build wind power that quickly, even in Germany, for example, the solar photovoltaics that are installed in Germany, they are more than the entire Fukushima 6 reactor complex. So they're getting more energy, more capacity from those installed photovoltaics in Germany than they are from the entire Fukushima complex. Even in Japan, after the earthquake and the tsunami, all the wind power installations in Japan seem to be working fine. Even the ones that were offshore are working fine. They were not damaged by the tsunami, and they're producing the electricity that people are now relying upon to deal with these crippled reactors. So Germany has, immediately following the Fukushima accident, Germany immediately shut down 7 more reactors on top of the 3 they had already shut down. They've got a total of about 17. And the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, has said that they are going to speed up the phase-out of nuclear power, and they are committed to completely getting rid of nuclear power. They're doing a very good job by switching over to alternatives. They're leading the way, and they're showing how by using smart grids, these smart grids are very important, because when you use a smart grid, which is sort of like the equivalent of the Internet as compared with old-fashioned typewriters, that you can use these intermittent sources of energy very, very well.
Thanks so much for joining us and taking us through these complex issues.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Gordon Edwards. He is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, and you can learn more about that organization at ccnr.org.